show at 92.6.
Neave Solicitors are proud to sponsor The Parent Show. The friendly team at Neave's includes specialists who can guide you through all the legal ups and downs of family life. Visit neavesolicitors.co.uk. Neave Solicitors, your complete legal solution.
A very warm welcome to The Parent Show tonight on a cold evening. We're keeping you warm with all our wisdom and knowledge, and tonight it's going to be emanating from someone who's been a guest on The Parent Show before. A very popular show that was before. She was talking about wills last time. But tonight we're going to be speaking to Sarah Belsom from Avidity Wealth Management. And Sarah's going to be talking about, well, Sarah, you can explain. We're going to be talking about the scary sounding EU directive on insurance premiums. It sounds very scary. How are you? Welcome to the studio.
Very good, Kathy. Thank you. So we'll be basically covering what's happening coming up in December with the cost of your life insurance and car insurance, because at the moment it's priced based on your gender, and that's all going to be changing and everything's going to be the same from December. So there's a lot of important things you need to bear in mind before then to secure cheaper life and car insurance.
Okay, we know that you've been submitting questions to Sarah. So we're going to play a little bit of the kinks, the money go round, and come back and get the ball rolling and find out all about the changes that are happening in the near future. Now, we're talking about money tonight with Sarah Belsom from Avidity Wealth Management. Now, Sarah, tell us about the EU gender directive. It sounded scary. What does it mean what as families, as parents, are we looking out for? And what are the, take us through what it means rather than us reading through all the literature on the web and trying to decipher it. Tell us from a parent perspective, what's it going to mean for us?
So the EU directive is basically changing the way that life insurance companies and insurance companies price insurance. Now, traditionally, insurance companies have looked at your age and your sex to determine how much your life insurance costs. So for women, for example, we tend to live longer than men, so our life insurance is cheaper. We also, on the car insurance side, tend to drive better, so our car insurance is cheaper. What will happen come December the 21st is that men's and women's life assurance and car insurance will be priced irrespective of your gender, so you'll pay the same rates, which will effectively mean that women will pay more for life assurance and car insurance. Now, in monetary terms, they expect that life insurance for women could go up by as much as 30%, which is a hefty old increase. Also, there are some tax changes coming in at the same time, which means that companies can't subsidise life insurance costs anymore. So that will also increase prices. Now, men don't get away scot-free either, because their income protection and health assurance for things like critical illness, which is like if you're diagnosed mm-hmm. with a critical illness mm-hmm. such as cancer mm-hmm. or heart attack or stroke, traditionally that's been slightly cheaper for men because they're less prevalent to it than women. Mm-hmm. The same with income protection, which is basically if you're not able to work through ill health for a long period of time, if you have a health protection plan or income protection or private health insurance, then that policy will pay you an equivalent to some level of salary until you're back on your feet and back able to work. Now, because as a result of the EU directive, it will increase the costs for men to women's rates.
Okay, so it's kind of evening up the scales
yes.
for everybody.
Yes.
So for families, it'll mean more cost, presumably.
Absolutely, yes. There's no winners in this except for the life assurance companies.
Okay.
Because they're not going to bring the premiums down to meet the cheaper ones. No. They're going to push the premiums up.
First of all, does this put us in line with the rest of Europe? Is this a European-wide?
Yes, it is. I mean, any directives, yes.
Everybody
will be the same.
Adhere to it. Okay.
Yes, yes. Yeah. But it is quite important to sort of act now, really, if you need to address any life assurance needs, or if your car insurance is coming up in, say, January or February, mm-hmm. it's actually worth thinking about sorting it before the prices increase to set to at least give yourself the rest of a year before the premiums will go up quite significantly.
So two things. Normally, if people are looking for insurance, they'll go straight to the web. They'll start looking for sites to go, I don't know, go compare, whatever they are. I don't know, you know, they start Googling where, you know, where to go. So what advice can you offer in independent financial advice as compared to sort of insurance companies, if you like?
Well, there's two different things. Car insurance is general insurance. So you can use the comparison websites, you know, Money Supermarket or Go Compare. Yeah. It is sometimes better to speak to a general insurance broker who's independent, because they are not swayed by the rates of any one particular company, okay. Whereas these comparison websites can actually be skewed by who pays them the most incentives to push their rates to the top of the tables.
Okay.
So using a general insurance broker for car insurance is the best thing.
Okay.
For life insurance, sure, you can use comparison websites. You could also go to your bank, but banks tend to be tied to a number of providers. So you'll never know, unless you go to an independent advisor, whether you're getting absolutely the best rates.
Okay.
So it's worth taking independent advice on all aspects of insurance.
Now, let's talk about life insurance, because we've had a few questions about that. I mean, first of all, it's not something we think about very much. I mean, I think my only knowledge about life insurance is that it must be really expensive. You know, on a monthly basis, it seems to be something that seems quite expensive.
Actually not. Life insurance has consistently come down in price over the last 10 years, simply because people are living longer.
Okay.
So that's a very important point, because if you took out a life insurance policy 5, 6, 7, 8 years ago, when you took out a mortgage, the chances are you should be able to replace it for less.
Okay.
So actually save money and have the same cover. Alternatively, you know, we find that client circumstances change. You might have increased your mortgage or had more children.
Mm-hmm.
You need a bit more cover. You could potentially use the savings to increase the cover to what you need now. So for anybody that has got an existing policy, it's a fantastic time to review it. By going to see an independent financial advisor who can just look at what you've got and see if it's possible to save you any money before the prices go up.
I think that's a very important point about renewal, because people think, oh, I've got my insurance, and they forget about it. And actually, our circumstances change. You have more children, you move house, you get a different job, your health changes. So how regularly do you think people should see an independent financial advisor in terms of intervals?
For life insurance, it's not like an annual thing, because like car insurance, you need to look at it, or home insurance, you need to look at it every year because the premium changes.
Yeah.
With life insurance, you can have guaranteed premiums, which are guaranteed for the whole term of the plan.
Okay.
But given that costs have come down consistently over the last 10 years, it's worth looking at it every 3, 4, 5 years to see if you can save any money. Now, obviously, the potential for making savings post 21st of December, when the EU regulations come in, will be less. So if you've got an existing policy that you've had for a little while, then definitely seek independent advice.
Okay.
It shouldn't cost you anything to see an independent financial advisor.
Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. It's a very simple thing for us to find out.
That's very helpful, isn't it? Can I just ask, so between sort of mum and dad and the family with the life insurance, do both of them need it? Or is that common that both of them get it?
Absolutely. As a general rule of thumb, we tend to recommend that people have enough to pay off the mortgage if they die, plus, for the main breadwinners, 4 times earnings, just so that in the event of something awful happening, you've got a house that's paid for that you can live in rent-free, and then you've got some money to live off, because the last thing you want if you're suffering a bereavement is then to have to go out to pay the bills. So to have some sort of leeway is good. For women that are stay-at-home mothers, they have a tremendous value on the family. If you lost a stay-at-home mother, then the cost of replacing them in terms of doing all the domestic duties, doing all the school runs, doing all the washing, the cleaning, the ironing,
everything. That's called everything.
Yeah.
And stand for stay-at-home dads.
Absolutely, absolutely. It's about $30,000 per annum because you'd need a nanny and you'd need a cleaner and you'd need somebody to do the shopping.
Somebody with 20 arms.
So women, even if you don't work, and get paid for it, because of course we all do work, should still have life assurance. When it comes to critical illness cover, it's always nice to have some cover, but never, because critical illness, which covers things like cancer and heart attacks and strokes, is on the increase. It is quite expensive.
Right.
So long as you have enough to give you a bit of leeway, because you might have a heart attack and actually get paid out the benefits but be perfectly fine, and it's just a bit of a bonus to get a lump sum from your life, from your critical illness.
And obviously people, if young parents are listening, say in their 20s, I'd call that young, is it cheaper to invest in life insurance at an earlier stage in your life?
Oh, absolutely, yes, the younger you are. It's based, life insurance costs at the moment are based on your mortality, your chance of dying.
Okay.
So if you're in your 20s, your life expectancy is probably 80 to 90 years. So if you've got a policy that's going to finish when you plan to pay off your mortgage at 60 or 65, chances are you won't die.
Okay.
So the premiums are really, really cheap. If you are in your 50s and you're a bit portly and you enjoy a few glasses of wine or smoke, then life insurance is obviously going to be more expensive.
What else did I just want to ask about that? And do you is it ever too late to get life insurance or too expensive?
It depends. When you look at life insurance, so you look at your age and your sex and whether you're a smoker. Smoker rates are far more expensive. So if you've stopped smoking or you don't smoke, it's obviously much cheaper.
Okay, so that's a variable that matters.
Absolutely, yes. So and a smoker is classed as somebody that smoked in the last 12 months.
Ooh, that's
so
all
there
right.
Is, if you've stopped smoking and you've had a sneaky one a couple of weeks ago, then it's probably best to wait until you've stopped smoking for a little while before you actually apply for life insurance again.
Okay.
Because they can do tests to see if you're telling
porkies. Now, that is a very valid question. I mean, I was just thinking, how do these people know if you smoke?
Yeah, they can do tests. It doesn't actually happen that often, but, you know, there's always that risk, and you don't want to lie on your life insurance
questionnaire. You certainly don't. If you have a cheeky fag, then you have to own up to it, please.
Yes.
Okay. Fab. Now, if you just joined us and wondering what on earth we're talking about, insurance with Sarah Belsom from Avidity Wealth Management. She's taking us through the maze of options that are out there and getting us thinking as parents about, well, very important issues. They're not very easy or humorous issues to talk about, but I think it's important people pay attention to them. So we'll come back to Sarah. We'll play a little bit of Morton Harkett. There's a blast from the past. Welcome to the Parent Show tonight. We're talking finances with none other than Sarah Belsom from Avidity Wealth Management. We've covered all manner of things, so if you've missed it, you're going to have to just listen to the podcast. But we're continuing our discussion. We mentioned a couple of very interesting points in the break. First of all, about non-married couples, Sarah. Are the rules in terms of insurance changing what's the situation if somebody's listening and they're not married?
Well, if you got life insurance and you're not married, it's really, really important that you, any policy that you have is put into trust.
Okay.
So that in the event of a claim, the benefits go straight to your partner or your children, for that matter, but they don't fall into your estate. Because if you're not married, you can only leave £325,000 worth of assets before your estate then is subject to inheritance tax, which is 40% on anything over and above
£325,000.
Okay. So say, for example, you own half a house that's worth $300,000, that's $150,000, and then you've got $400,000 in life cover, then your estate is $550,000. You would only get the first $325,000 tax-free.
And then pay 40%.
Then your partner would pay 40% on the balance.
Okay.
So just by completing a simple trust form, it means it doesn't fall inside of your estate because you've given it away prior to any potential claim.
But you could create a will and say that my insurance goes to, can you say that in the will that it'll?
Yes, I mean, you need to also have a simple trust document. It doesn't cost anything to put a policy into trust.
I mean, it's very easy things to put in place, really, that would save such a lot of heartache.
Absolutely. So existing policies, you should make sure that they're put into trust. And if, say, for example, you've had a relationship breakdown, and when you set it up, it was in trust for your husband or your wife or your partner, then it's really important to change the beneficiaries to your children or to whoever you want to leave it to. Now, that's, again, a very simple procedure, but it makes a massive difference because the last thing you'd want is for it to go to an estranged partner that you don't want them to benefit.
Absolutely.
The other point that you picked up is on the will. It's absolutely critical that everybody has a will, because you never know if you're going to get run over by a bus. But if you die without a will, then intestacy rules determine who gets what.
Now, is this meaning when you're not married to each other?
Even if you're married or unmarried. Even if you're married, you can only, without a will, leave about $275,000 to your husband or your wife, then your children get a certain amount, and then the rest of your family get the rest of your estate.
I don't want that happening. What?
Yes, so, and you can't assume that people will just think, well, they wanted me to have it all, so I'm going to get it.
Unfortunately, as often happens in families,
exactly.
Isn't it? Causing all sorts of trouble.
If it's not written down in a valid will that's been witnessed and set up properly, then you might as well not have anything.
And these are very simple measures to put in place. Now, we've got a few questions for you. You ready? You're on the hot seat, Sarah.
Yeah, go for it.
If you're self-employed, what financial actions would you recommend in terms of insurance?
Well, I'm self-employed, so I have enough life cover to pay off the mortgage, plus some to leave to my family. So that's life assurance.
Okay.
Now, obviously, when you're working out, if you're looking at optimum levels of enough to pay off your mortgage plus four times your earnings, you can knock off things like the value of your pension assets, because they would be paid tax-free to your family in the event of your death. So don't forget to take that off. And things like savings, because they would be paid out potentially on your death. I would also consider some critical illness cover, although it is expensive, because cancer rates and heart attacks are on the up.
Okay.
So some critical illness cover, just to give you a bit of breathing space. The other thing to bear in mind is what would happen to you if you were unable to work through ill health. Now, if you are employed, the really good question to ask your employers or look in your contracts is to see how long they would actually pay you before you'd be reliant upon state benefits, which are derisory. You know, it's less than £100
a
week.
It's not something anybody, nobody listening knows the answer to that.
No. Now, if you're self-employed, you're on your own. So how long could you physically survive and pay your bills before you have no money left?
The second part of his question was, if you leave full employment, how can you maintain the same health insurance cost effectively?
Well, if you leave insurance, some employers will maintain cover for a minimal period to give you chance to get yourself back on your feet. But it's really important that if you're losing benefits like death in service, which is basically life assurance, but generally termed as a multiple of your salary, like four times earnings or two times earnings,
which some people will have.
Yes. Yeah. If you're leaving a job and going self-employed, then you need to think, well, I actually do need that cover. So seek independent advice to replace that cover, especially if you've got a mortgage or you've got children and the dependents that rely on your income.
And also for older parents who may have grandchildren, I think it's just as applicable, because they may want to renew things or change the beneficiaries. Okay. Sarah, many parents are looking at alternatives to banks to put their money into now, given the backlash of the banking industry. What advice can you give on this? And can you understand people's irritation with banks? She's the spokesperson for the city.
No. Oh dear, yes. Well, banks are profit-making institutions, and if you're looking at bank deposits, you know, interest rates are at an all-time low and have been for quite a number of years now, at 0.5%. So if you've got money to invest in savings, then, you know, 0.5% is nothing. Then you pay tax on it,
right.
And then you have to think about the effects of inflation. So the last inflation figures were 2.5%. So if you're only earning 0.5%, it's actually going down in value in real terms by 2.5%. So you're losing real value money. Now, whether or not you invest in something else depends on how long you can afford to tie it up for, if you can tie it up at all. It's worth, if you might need it in the short term, then it's definitely worth looking at sort of higher interest rate deposit accounts and looking at things like the Money Advice Service, you know, this MAR advert on the TV, to see who's got the best interest rates. If you can afford to tie it up for 5 years plus, then it's worth thinking about investing in a spread of investments in the stock market through vehicles such as ISAs, independent.
Lovely. Okay. Now we're going to take a call now from Greg, who's listening in St Albans. Greg, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Kathy.
Can you hear us okay?
Oh, yeah.
Great. Greg, what's your comment?
Yeah, I just have a comment along the lines of the question, previous question. Considering that 2012 is the United Nations International Year of Cooperatives, and the debates are raging about reining in big banks, which include big insurance companies. So I was wondering if you had any advice about more sustainable or more ethical insurance companies that people could go to for, as you were saying, life insurance or health insurance.
Well, in terms of insurance, there aren't many ethical insurance companies. There are ethical banks, such as the Cooperative and Triodos Bank.
Sarah, sorry, can you just explain what that means? What does it mean to be an ethical bank?
Ethical means socially responsible. So they're not necessarily looking at the bottom line profit.
Okay.
They're actually looking to look after their members, like the old traditional building societies.
Okay.
You know, they were set up, and the friendly societies, they were set up for the benefit of their members. And any profits they make go back into the members' pots, basically.
Okay.
So you get bonuses every year, or you get dividends.
And there's no danger of them going under?
Well, that's down to their good lending policies. So, you know, banks that go bust have probably lent too much money to people that can't afford to repay their debts and been irresponsible in the amount that they lent them. Things like, you know, 100% mortgages where you know, people borrow everything, so they've not committed any of their own money. That's quite irresponsible.
Yeah.
And if you do that too much and then the economy gets into trouble, you know, then they can't pay their debts off. And that's when, you know, if that happens on a big scale, that's when banks go bust.
So the bottom line, Greg, is no, there are no ethical insurance companies.
Well, the Cooperative,
the cooperative
is an insurance company as well. I think there's an arm of the Cooperative that does insurance.
Yes, they have an independent insurance arm as well.
So, but that is, I mean, for us, it's buildings and contents, but I don't think they offer life insurance as far as I know, or say, I think there is travel as well. But.
No, I mean, you can get ethical or socially responsible independent financial advisors who can advise you on good funds to invest in that are socially responsible.
Oh, that's
so if you have religious views and you want to avoid certain things, or you are opposed to arms or nuclear or tobacco, there are investment funds that you can invest, say, your pensions or your investments in that avoid certain areas. That's called negative screening, where you avoid all the baddies. There's also positive screening, where you have funds who invest in companies that are socially responsible, that do sign up to certain standards,
right,
or invest in things that make a positive contribution to the environment or to society.
That's very interesting. So again, what you're offering yourself is options, talking through who people are and tailoring it to
absolutely
their values.
Absolutely,
their needs.
Yes. So there's Sharia funds for the sector of the community that can't make a profit from people. There's also, all sorts of funds that independent financial advisors and financial advisors can talk about that, will tailor their needs to particular views.
In terms of the clients that you get, do you get everyone coming in from all sections of society coming in? I mean, is it common for people to say that, to know about that?
It used to be quite trendy about 10 years ago when socially responsible or ethical funds were going up because they were investing in growth industries. I used to work for a company that sold ethical funds. In fact, I did pensions for some very big ethical organisations. And it was quite trendy because you were making a positive contribution, but at the same time you were also making a lot of profit for people and a lot of growth.
Right.
It's when the wheels fall off that even good quality companies that are really responsible can be tarred with the same brush as all the baddies. Yeah. And it doesn't matter how good you are.
Right.
If the market's, the economy's falling apart, they can still go down. But it is certainly a specialist area.
And there's, I think it would be very difficult as a layperson sort of to be able to find your way around and know which are ethical. So I think you...
Yes, I mean, it's something that a good independent financial advisor would ask. Do you have any specific ethical requirements from your investments?
We know that you say that people can... I mean, the last time you were on, you said people can come down, just have a free chat. And I think you did have people doing that. What happens in a consultation?
So the first meeting is really for the financial advisor to find out about the client. So it's their opportunity to tell you about your circumstances. So this is who we are. I'm employed. I have children. I'm on this earnings. My outgoings are this. I have these assets, these liabilities, debts. And then we get to talk about the interesting stuff. What are your objectives? Do you want to retire at 60 on a pension of XYZ? Do you want your children to go to university and you want to help fund for that?
So these are things.
Do you want your mortgage paid off?
It's very interesting because I think it's a good chat to have because it makes you think about the things that you should be thinking about.
Absolutely.
So if you haven't really considered your life's plan or financial strategy.
Well, most people don't.
Most people
don't. You don't wake up in the morning and think,
I should be doing
this.
I'd like to be retired now. That's what I think when I wake up. Now, Greg, we've still got you. What would you just like to add to that?
A basic question. You said that the first consultation was free.
Yes.
And is the catch the second?
Well, then at that point, if you've identified some needs, say, for example, to sort out your pension or take out a pension, or you need some life assurance or other cover, or you need to do an investment, then we would talk about how we would charge for that going forward. But we are very heavily regulated and we have to agree charges up front now. The regulations on our advisor charging is changing massively at the end of the year, so there will no longer be advisors able to rip people off because you have to agree it. It's very transparent, agreed up front, which is good for the industry, for our reputation.
Okay, so things
are good for the client.
Oh,
absolutely, massively, massively.
Now, a couple of other questions. I've recently split from my husband and live alone with my two children in St Albans. I'm worried about my finances. Are there any particular financial insurance packages that cater for single parents? Will life insurance be much more expensive for me now that I'm sole carer for my children?
Well, the answer to that is you need to think about what your needs are. So you are a carer to your children, you might be working. So what happens if you can't work? How long would your employer pay for you? If you're self-employed, then how long could you survive without an income coming in? So thinking about income protection.
Okay.
permanent health insurance is another name for it. So what happens if you can't work through ill health? Then what happens if you die?
Right.
Very important to have a will that discusses, you know, who will take over looking after the children. It's then, you know, what will they live off? Where will they live? Do you have a house that will have a mortgage that's repaid?
Okay.
So do you have life assurance that will repay the mortgage so that at least the children inherit some money? They can either stay in the house with a carer or sell the house and move in with your chosen guardians.
Lots to think about. We're going to have a little break and give Sarah a chance to have some of the water in front of her here. Back on the Parent Show, joining us again, it's Sarah Belsom. Sarah, before you leave, we've got some more listener questions we'd like to get across. These are cheeky ones because they're about pensions, they're not about insurance. But they're all getting their money's worth here. Is it still mandatory, Sarah, to buy an annuity once you take your pension?
No, indeed. The rules changed quite some time ago. I think it was about 95 when I graduated, that you no longer have to buy an annuity with your pension. So with the pension, you put money in, you get tax relief, it grows tax-free, and when you get to retirement, you can take 25% as a tax-free lump sum if you want it, and then the rest you use to secure an income. Now, traditionally, you'd buy what's called an annuity, which is a fixed income for life.
Okay.
Now, that means at the time that you retire, you then decide, okay, do I want a pension for me or do I want a pension that gives my partner, husband, wife a pension when I die, if I die first?
Yep.
Do I want one that goes up in value every year with inflation, or do I want one that stays the same? Do I want any guarantees? And then your pension, once you've set it, is paid for life. Now, that it doesn't matter if you live for 5 years or you live for 35 years. It's guaranteed. As an alternative to that, you can actually do income withdrawals. So you kind of treat your pension like a money box where you can dip in each year and take benefits.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if it stays in your name and it continues to hopefully grow because it's invested, but you run the risk that if you're taking more out of the pot each year than it's growing by, you could potentially run out of money before you die.
Yeah.
So there are risks associated with that. But it can be quite useful for some clients that have, say, other assets that they can provide an income from in retirement.
Okay.
If they are ill and they don't think they're going to live for a long time, or as is the case now, annuity rates are really poor because of the way annuity rates are calculated.
Yeah, this
so they don't think it's very good value for money.
What kind of annuity rate should I factor in?
Annuity rates at the moment, until the EU directive comes in 21st of December, are based on your age and your sex. So traditionally, women tend to live longer, so they actually get a worse deal than men who are expected to live shorter lives.
No surprises there.
So come December, there will be a level playing field. But say, for example, you've got a man who is retiring at the age of 60 and he wants to buy a pension for himself that will stay the same for life.
Mm-hmm.
He could get, with £100,000 of fund after he's taken his tax-free cash, an income of £5,135 a year, payable for life. That stays the same. A woman with the same amount of money would only get £4,945 at the moment at 60. So because they're expected to live longer, they get a slightly worse deal because they're expected to have it paid for longer.
Okay.
If you were to wait till 65, then for £100,000 worth of fund, you could get nearly £6,000 on the best rates. And for a woman, it would be £5,600 odd. Now, of course, the caveat to that is the rules are changing come December, so they'll be the same. But if you add other things like a spouse's benefit, then depending on how old the spouse is, you'd sacrifice a bit of pension. The biggest cost with an annuity is if you want it to go up in line with inflation. Generally speaking, if you were to get an annuity of £10,000 a year, if you wanted it to go up by inflation, you could expect it to start at about £7,000 a year. So you've got to think, right, if I'm going to do this increasing, I've got to be fairly sure that I'm going to live for long enough for it not to only catch up with the original starting level for a level pension, but to go way beyond that, right. because in the interim period, you've had less. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So if you're going to buy an increasing pension, you've got to be, you know, you've got to have parents that have lived quite long into their retirement to give yourself a chance of getting your money back.
Rattling through these really quickly, should I opt out or in of the new workplace pension schemes?
That's quite a big thing. These workplace pension schemes that you see advertised on the TV are basically forcing employers to offer a pension scheme. Now, at the moment, it only applies to the really big companies, the M&Ss, the Tescos. And at the moment, employers only need to put in 1% of salary for employees, and the employees only need to put in 0.8% of salary. So on the basis, and then the government top up their 0.8 to 1% with tax relief. So on the basis that it costs you 0.8% of your salary to get 2%, it's a no-brainer.
Okay.
Now, some companies will offer better schemes than that. So obviously, you know, if you've got a better scheme than that, with yeah, just paying more yeah. in, it's worth doing it. With pension contributions, often companies insist that you pay in. But you have to think that with tax relief, if you have to pay 5% of salary, it's only going to cost you 4% mm-hmm. because you get the tax relief. Okay. And if you're a high rate taxpayer, so your income's over 42,750, you can get a bit more tax relief back. So it actually only costs you 3%. So if the company's going to put in 5 and you've got to put in 5, it actually only costs you 3 or 4%, depending on how much tax you pay, to get 10%. So it's an absolute bargain.
Gosh, you're clever. Last pension question. I read something about a change in the measurement of inflation from CPI to RPI. I don't know what that means. How will this affect pensions? That's our last pension question.
It's actually the other way around. CPI is the cost of a basket of goods, but it doesn't include the price of housing, you know, rent or mortgages. Retail price index includes the cost of houses. They are actually calculated slightly differently, but generally RPI is slightly higher than CPI. Now, the government have been quite canny in changing the calculations to increases in CPI because, surprise, surprise, it's lower.
Right.
So it means that your state pensions and other benefits, state benefits, will go up by a lesser percentage than the actual cost of living, mm-hmm. which is RPI.
Okay, we've had two more emails. One about tracker ISAs.
Okay.
Be happy to answer random yeah. questions.
Yes.
What are Sarah's thoughts on tracker ISAs? Well, can you just explain what they are?
Okay, so an ISA is an individual savings account. It's a tax-free savings account. You can have cash ISAs where you invest in cash bank accounts through banks and building societies. Mm-hmm. You can have stocks and shares ISAs where you invest in investment funds. Now, some companies like Virgin or M&S will offer tracker funds, which are basically tracking a stock market. So if you've ever heard of the FTSE 100 is the top 100 companies in the UK. So a tracker ISA will track, if it's a FTSE tracker, mm-hmm. will track the performance of the top 100 companies.
Science.
So they go yes. up and down, you know, according to how well the companies perform. Now, trackers, you don't actually have to buy all the stocks in the FTSE to replicate it. So they tend to be quite cheap to run.
Okay.
Because they use sophisticated systems that mm-hmm. replicate it. You could then go on to invest in active funds, which are slightly more expensive, but you've got fund managers determining what they invest in.
Brilliant. Okay, Sarah, we've taken up so much. I know that Claire Healy is banging on the door as we speak. We just want to thank Sarah Belsom very, very much for coming in. Sarah is from Avidity Wealth Management. We could have spoken to you all night about all these questions. We've still got questions we haven't even answered. Sarah, if people want to get in touch with you, do they just go to your website, which is...
Yeah, it's www.aviditywealthmanagement.com.
Avidity Wealth Management.com.
A-V-I-D-I-T-Y. Or our telephone number is 01727-898880.
Okay, so it's Sarah Belsom, and you're based in Phoenix House in St Albans. So
yes.
People can track you down tomorrow, give you a ring, get that first consultation booked. Come on. Okay, thanks a lot, Sarah. All the very, very best. Thanks for coming in. Thank you for listening tonight. It's been our pleasure. Next week, we've got Oliver James, author of Love Bombing. on uniquely on the Parents Show at Radio Vellum. Look him up, Oliver James, really, really famous author. Have a great evening. It's been a pleasure. All the very best.
Neave Solicitors are proud to sponsor the Parents Show. The friendly team at Neave's includes specialists who can guide you through all the legal ups and downs of family life. Visit neavesolicitors.co.uk. Neave Solicitors, your complete legal solution.